The name is Mulefend, and most of the things are already on the bulletin board. My only regret is that it is going to take some time for you to get used to my way of speaking. And if you are patient, I'll try to be maybe slow, or if I pronounce some word strangely, stop me and ask me what I mean. I have problems, for an example, saying water. I struggle when I'm in restaurants. I say to some people, can I please have some water? Said, what do you want? Water. What? And I'm getting confused. How should I say it? I just say in America, you're saying
beer.
Well, thank you. The theme of the series of my lectures is going to be on aspects of African Christianity, or other people call African theology. And today I will focus mainly on what is also called African Christology, or the way Christ is viewed in African culture or societies or by African people. And but before I do that and share with you what I enumerated as very interesting faces of Jesus in Africa, I would like to start by giving a brief introduction to this whole aspect of African Christianity. One should note firstly that there is an interesting, a growing interest among African scholars to rediscover their identity, or what is also called Afrocentricism. There are a number of books that are being published with a focus on the African perspective of something, African perspective of family, healing, medicine, psychology, counseling, African marriage, and so on and so on. There is a very growing interest about that, and it's not only in theology, African art, architecture, etc., etc. And an example of such what is called African Renaissance is in American inner cities. I'm sure most of you have heard the debate around the Black History Month in America, which is somewhere around February, where most of the inner city schools are talking about the Afrocentricism versus Eurocentricism in the curriculum of what they are being taught at schools. So there is a very growing interest on the whole notion of African identity. And in some respects, this interest has to do with a reaction, and to some people, a disappointment with what they thought are the promises of a Western or European culture. And as a reaction to that, people are beginning to say, oh, why don't we try and go there? And in my opinion, I think there are the whole debate of Afrocentricism and Eurocentricism sometimes gets off the line, because a lot is being missed about what Eurocentricism really stands for in terms of the industrial ingeniousness that were inventions that were made out of Europe. And one can mention many things, including the democratic values, the liberal values, and also to a very large extent Christian virtues. Now I won't go into this whole debate, because I think, even though it is very interesting when you look into African Christianity, it sometimes gets a little bit off. The other reason is that most of the debate is not well informed about what Europe really stands for. and what Europe's contribution or heritage is. And an interesting point is that most of the people who are very unkind in their criticism are Europeans themselves, or people with European background, who kind of have a very negative view about their past and heritage that they have handed over to other people. Now, my view is that these issues of different cultures, whether Eurocentrism or Afrocentrism, are very difficult and complex. It's not very easy just to say to glorify African traditions and culture, and on the other hand to condemn one culture. There is a lot in these cultures, and I think this is the first important point which is going to be repeated in all my lectures, that the cultures are not there. You cannot just simplify them and say it's this culture is bad, or this culture is backward, or this culture is advanced. There are aspects and elements in cultures which are worth retaining, and some other elements which are worth changing. And if you go into that process, it's a very difficult thing. We should actually resist this temptation to simply change and get rid and want a new thing, and we want the new age and a new culture and a new language and so on. Just don't do that, please. One therefore needs to learn, as I say, how to measure cultures. And as I said, as a general rule, they are very complex. You have Chinese cultures, Indian cultures, Arabic or Semitic cultures, and African cultures. And one cannot even talk of the inferior and the superior cultures. There are certain things which are very superior in non-Western cultures, and say are certain things which are very much advanced in Western culture. So this whole thing is just very complex, and I'm just saying this as a preparation, so that when I talk about aspects of African Christianity and theology, one needs to know where I come from and the approach in which I identify myself with. And therefore we could then maybe help to get rid of the confusion that exists today amongst the many people who are critics of culture, especially of Western culture. And some of these people are meaning well. They mean well. It's not as if they are very vindictive or what. They mean well. They've experienced the world wars, and they see the global the environment being threatened, and then they begin to say there is something wrong about our American way of life. There is something wrong about the German way of life. And unfortunately, I think that even those who means well, there are certain things that they miss. One person, for an example, in Chicago, who said to me, as I told him my background, where I come from, and my historical, my Christian upbringing, and the whole struggles people of faith had to go through in South Africa in particular. And then when I told him that I'm engaged in graduate studies at Chicago, he said, "What do you need Chicago to teach you? You coming from where you come from, you really don't even have to come here to learn anything." And I think these people, as I say, they mean well, but they're missing a point. Because you are going to meet a lot of Africans who are interested in knowing a lot about European or Western aspects of life. And in fact, who want to adopt some of them? And then it confuses you, because some people would say, "Oh, but you should be happy in an African village, the way you live, your family and your style of marriages are the best. Why do you want to copy ours?" And they miss the point that the whole thing is not just as simple as that. It's very complex. Now, I think that part of what I'm going to say is that it is exactly at this point of failing to understand cultures, including African culture, that Western Christians, European Christians, failed in their Africanization, rather in the Christianization of Africa. Because the attitude, the mentality, the worldview and perceptions they had was that they are bringing something superior to something that is empty, that will simply die without this. Instead of beginning to see this living culture as a dynamic culture on its own, which has its own pluses and minuses. And if we react to that mistake, the other way around will be simply committing the same mistake. And I think that as an African scholar, this is basically the kind of a dialectic and combination that I'm trying to promote in what I my views about African Christianity. Because most of the European Christians, or the way it was brought, it was with a clear message that you cannot be Christian and retain your African culture. You had to make a choice. So in a sense, therefore, Christianity was presented as being anti-African. And you can judge that by a whole lot of ways in which the message was brought. You had to change your name and get a new name. If you were baptized as an adult, my name is Molefe, for example. And whether I liked it or not, I had to get a name. My father has a very difficult native name, but he ended up being called Johannes because he had to be baptized. And so on and so on, the whole list. And then you had to change your address, you had to do a lot of things. And this shows the approach, the way it came. Basically, it meant that when you became a convert, you were simultaneously being westernized, and which was part of where the problem is. So, as I said, what we are realizing today is that there is a realization that there is no single culture on earth is God ordained. No single culture on earth has God's favor, that God says this is my culture. No single language on earth is the language of the gods. That actually we are all on the same historical and human plane. And the moment you begin to view it that way, and the moment you begin to enter into foreign cultures in that with that understanding, you will be more, I think, more liberated, more prepared to begin to know what you can learn and what you cannot learn. Because even some Africans tended to think that, especially well-meaning Christian Africans. I know, for example, in my experience, the elders in my congregation, thought that the missionaries were the Lord. If I succeeded a missionary in a particular area, the missionary said, "You baptize in this way." If I tell them, "No, you shouldn't baptize in that way," the elders will say, no, you don't know, the missionary told us to do it this way. Because according to them, there is no way you could challenge or you could question a person who is European. And so this is why, where therefore this whole change is happening. Now, we must now begin to ask whether can Christianity become incarnated in African culture in the same way that Jesus was able to be incarnated in first century Palestine as a Jew? Can it happen? And this is a question that has not been addressed seriously so far. In other words, the theme of my lecture is the central question of confession. What do, as Jesus asked Peter, what do people say I am, who I am? How do people, in that instance, he was mainly referring to the people at that time, the Jews mainly. Who do these Jews say I am? And you could remember that Peter's answer was to invoke Jewish messianic figures. They say you are Elijah, they say you are so and so. And in the end he said, what do you say I am? Now, what African theologians are saying is now, is what does African people say who Jesus is? And that is the basic question of what is called African Christology. And this question relates to us to the seriousness of incarnation, the indwelling of Christ in human life and history. We must be willing to admit that this is not a wrong question to ask, because if we take seriously the Christian message, we say that it is necessary to ask that question. It is a legitimate question. Now, before we look at the various faces of Jesus in Africa, I want to make not very long remarks about African theology, except to say firstly that there is an infinite varieties of Africans or African cultures and societies in the African continent. One of the most frustrating things coming from Africa is to meet the Americans who really think that there is a homogeneous African culture. And they would say that, oh, but you understand in Ghana you do this. And there is such a big difference between Africans on the south of the equator and Africans on the north of the equator. In the same way that sometimes actually you may find that certain groups in Africa are closer, for example, to Italians than they are to other Africans. So sometimes even the word African, it's misleading on its own. And scholars are using it with caution. Sometimes when you use it, you need to further explain what you really mean. And there are many schools of African theologies. One school is what they call the inculturation school, and the other one, so on. It's just a long, complex thing about it. The case that I am going to be making here is that in spite of all these differences, there exist distinct African forms of understanding Jesus Christ. And these are the forms that I will be sharing with you. The crucial question, as I am just trying to repeat it, I've already mentioned it, is whether can the Christ of the Jews and Europeans also become the Christ of the Africans? In other words, is Jesus, do we simply translate him in African languages in the same way that you just translate from Latin to English, or does Jesus become an African? Now, this is a very difficult, because when you say Jesus is an African, you are not talking about translation of language, you are talking about a certain way of life, a certain understanding, a certain ontology. Now, can Jesus become an African? And I'm arguing that for some reasons we need to say in our faith, if we understand the incarnation properly, it is possible, and it is only necessary, it becomes necessary within certain understanding. But therefore the whole issue is that there is nothing wrong in beginning to understand Jesus as an African. even though we do not mythologize the Africanness of Jesus by pretending as if he was never a Jew. I'm not sure how many of you are aware of a book which was published sometime in the late 60s in America by a certain Detroit minister, Albert Click. It's called The Black Messiah, where basically Albert Click was trying to argue in a scholarly way that according to archaeological findings and certain documents, Jesus was black, basically saying that his skin was black and so on and so on. And of course, many, many African scholars later said that no, there is no, neither that issue in first century Palestine, that issue of blackness was not even an issue for those people. You were either a Jew in the sense of your religion, your circumcision, etc. And so basically, if we want to say Jesus' skin was black, we are reading 21st century problems into first century Palestine, which never existed then. But also, they were saying that you may be playing ideological games with Jesus, because possibly he was not black, and there is no real evidence that he had a beard or he was of this height, etc., etc. Nobody really knows about those things. So you are not going to begin to claim him for your, because then it becomes an ideological game. So what you need to say is that he may not even have been black, I don't care. The fact of the matter is that his lifestyle is such that he showed so much compassion to women, to the people who were outsiders, that to me that is enough. I don't have to believe in Jesus because he was an African or what. I just need to say his lifestyle, he was definitely a Jew. His lifestyle was such that he made everybody to be one of his, and that is enough. So you don't have to go into the whole ideological game of saying Jesus had to be a man or what before I can relate to him. Now that is just by the side. Now, therefore, the point I'm trying to make is that the African Christological images are necessary. They are not something that is off the way. Now, what are the examples of these faces of Jesus? The first one is the imagery of what is called the Master of Initiation. I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with initiation. Possibly you have heard of it. Now, a Master of Initiation is a new image that is being some especially some French-speaking Africans from places like Cameroon are coming up with this. And just I want to say something about this this new search for African Christologies. It is very interesting that theologians who are very, very serious about this project are Catholic theologians from Africa. Most of the literature that is written about African theology or Christianity now is written by Catholics, and I'm struggling to understand whether is there something within Catholicism which encourages them to do that, and whether is there something within maybe Episcopalian Methodist Lutheranism which makes people to think that it is wrong to even try to experiment on that. Anyway, one theologian, I think his name is Anselm Sanon. He's from Northwest Africa. He writes about Jesus as the Master of Initiation, and the crux of this Master of Initiation is that in traditional society, initiation was a very, very crucial activity or event, and the person who was in charge of initiation was more like he played the role of the philosopher, historian, more or less the pope of the village. He was the link between the past and the generations that were coming. Now, when these people said Jesus is the Master of Initiation, they imagined the Hebrew notion of rabbi, where Jesus is the rabbi. However, there is an important difference here. Welcome. There is an important difference here in the sense that they were able, the Africans were saying, yes, Jesus is the master of initiation. However, he's a different kind of master, because whereas the other tribal initiation masters had to learn something from somebody in order to be very good initiation master, Jesus' authority was with himself. In other words, Jesus was a different kind of master of initiation. He taught things not because he learned it from his elders or so, but because he is the source of authority. So that is one phase of Jesus. The other phase of Jesus is Jesus as the witch. We may call it the witch doctor, because this is not how Africans understand the translation of what you call a witch doctor would be a medicine man or a healer. Now, again, you need to you can understand this imagery of Jesus within the role in which witch doctors played in the society, because witch doctors were seen as people who were centers of divine power, who can intervene in inexplicable tragedies and crises, or like illness, etc., etc. And so, if they began to say, well, in the traditional life we have a witch doctor, a medicine man, Jesus is that person, because then they began to see Jesus as the healer, Jesus as the one who controlled fate, Jesus as the one who was the center of divine power. So that image, which always has been there, fitted Jesus as they read the Gospels about how Jesus acted in the parables. The third image is that of the chief, or what is also called the elder brother. The elder brother was the first among his siblings. He was the most responsible person. He had all the responsibilities to him. And as they read the Bible about Jesus as Lord, for them, the understanding of Lord was similar to the one of a chief. But then, an interesting thing about these images or faces is that each and every one of them, as the Africans adopted it, they simultaneously transformed their own. In other words, they did not just see Jesus as the chief and equated him to the chiefs they knew, but they began to see him as the kind of chief who transforms their understanding of chiefs. He becomes a different type of a medicine man. He becomes a different type of initiation leader. He becomes a different type of an elder brother. His kind of dominion is different from that of the chiefs they knew, etc., etc. And the final one that I want to share with you today is Jesus as ancestor. Now, this image of Jesus as an ancestor is also one of the most central and widespread images throughout Africa. You go almost societies, there is a belief in ancestorship, and it had to do also with the link between the living and the dead. It had to do with the understanding of mediation. How do one reach God? And Jesus had to be that. But then again, Jesus had to be a different kind of ancestor, and hence Africans talk of Jesus as what they call proto-ancestor. Proto may mean first or head or chief ancestor, but he became a different kind of an ancestor. In any way, all these images began to play a role among Africans. And the situation today is that they are, as I talk about the Renaissance, they are re-emerging. And people are beginning to rediscover them and beginning to ask questions. What does it mean today to be an educated African and begin to understand Jesus and Jesus as the medicine man and so on and so on? So these are some of the images that have some meaning. Now, the question I want to pose, and this is the question I want to pose every time I meet in a session like this, is so what? How interesting, or how it's something like watching a public television program of a very interesting old age myth in somewhere, and you begin to say, well, so what? what is this to do with us and with you, etc., etc. Now, there are threefold answers to this, which are directing my lectures. The first one is that I'm going to try to attempt to give you a broader understanding of the Christian faith in terms of emphasizing its varieties and richness. You begin to understand that the Christian faith, in some respect, its strength is its adaptability. Its strength is not Mohammedanism or what you want other Muslim or Islam, where you take it or leave it as it is in the Quran. Don't change it, don't edit, etc. The Christian faith is such that it is rich, it has Hellenistic notions. If you talk of the Logos, Jesus is the Word, that is a very central Greek understanding of the divine, of reason. And it's interesting how even from the first century, when the church started, Christianity was able to show its strength or resilience by not being threatened by these foreign things. And that is a very important thing, because the courage we should have in moving to the unknown as Christians will come out of the knowledge and the faith that there is nothing that can threaten Christianity. It's so rich, it's so far, it's so broad that it is capable of addressing any situation. And that is the first thing about this. The second point is that we need to attempt this, we answer the so what of the African Christianity. We need to begin to help ourselves to see our own culture and our own theology and our own civilization as one among many, not as the one and only. Because this notion of one and only is what I call the ideologization of our own understanding. We universalize our own narrow interpretation. We say, because this is how we understand a prosperous life, everybody else should say a successful, prosperous family must be ABC. Now, there are many different ways in which people can define prosperity. And so, I think that the opportunity to be exposed to different cultures, to let those different cultures to speak and say, this is who we are, it helps to de-ideologize you, because it suddenly opens your mind to say, oh, I thought this was the only way to look at this. So it's not merely an academic interest in curiosity and say, how interesting. It's basically speaking to you. The final so what is to begin to be appreciative and respectful of the other, of the strange, of the foreign. I think it's one thing to recognize that there is something different to you. It's a different thing to recognize it and further to respect it. To recognize that it has set its own values and merits. And not simply to say, oh, it's there, but it's backward. It will reach where we are later on. Maybe give it 50 years, they will be where we are. It's a different way of relating with others. So therefore, this exposure into African Christianity, I see it as a way of American Christians looking at the religiosity and religious practice of African Christians and treat it with respect and dignity. And I think that this will in turn promote the way we regard other people and will also promote what we call human dignity and respect. Well, let me pause here and begin to ask you to enter into conversation with me.
I'd say one other why are we doing this, and that is that in certain African countries, faith is much more central and much more vibrant than it is in our American culture. And just like we look at liberation theology in Central and South America and say, why don't we have that happening in our culture? I think that to know more about what's happening, again, it may not be something that can transport here, but it is a challenge to us.
Oh, yes. Actually, one of the interesting things being in America this year is seeing you confused with your presidential elections in November. and it is very interesting that sometimes you listen to what other people call the sermonization of your vice president about family values and so on. Basically, he speaks in this respect like what a conservative traditionalist African will say. And so there is a sense in which kind of one can say we're going in full circle. You see, there are certain things which are so basic in life that does no matter how advanced you go, they still remain there, family being one of them. And so as you talk about what African Christians has retained as the world developed, then the notion of a certain sacred space in their life and the notion of a certain unexplainability of that thing in their lives. And that is the thing that makes them every day to go to church on Sunday to make sense religion. In other words, religion has not been explained away in a normal African situation. Of course, people can stop going to church if they think that the church demands the Lord, etc., etc., but they remain religious. You can, there is a joke in among African scholars that Africans are incurably religious. That you can, they have this disease of simply being religious, and you cannot cure them of that disease. You can take them anywhere. When the bottom hits, they begin to think, oh, wait, why did God do this, etc., etc. That's the only logical explanation they begin to have about that.
This evolution you speak of, or this look at the African face, one you mentioned, has that grown out as more ministers of color have taken leadership from the ones originally brought missionaries from Europe and from America who were white, who had their cultural focus that, as you say, that they put on the Africans, and they did. But now, as a white European influence is, in a sense, being supplanted, and even literally brought out sometimes, this look at the African cultural focus is, that's coming about because the leadership has changed.
Well, like I said, the first thing is that it is interesting that it is more active and prominent among Catholics. It looks to me like the Catholics decided to take seriously the local cultures or the contextualization of theology more than many other religions or faith denominations. Now, regarding the role or the impact of African ministers who maybe have taken over from missionaries in the last 15, 20 years, you cannot necessarily say this is happening because suddenly the bishops are Africans. No. actually, most of the problems we have is because of our African ministers and church leadership, who, for various reasons, education, etc., still, most of them still think that African culture is heathen. Now, these are African bishops. And interestingly enough, which is one of the ironies of history, is that the crop of missionaries who are going to Africa today are more sensitive about these issues than the past their colleagues they're going to work with, either in Zaire or wherever. They are less condemnatory of certain African. I think there is a sense of humility and say, you know, our forefathers did so many mistakes. I don't want to be one who does those mistakes again. And in the process of doing that, begin to encourage Africans to say, don't you have your own rhythm of singing this song? The words are good, but maybe can't you get a different rhythm of singing it? And they begin to encourage African worship, African liturgy, etc., etc. Now, these are not necessarily Africans. So that is something which I said, that it's important that people know. It's not a simple, straightforward issue of Europeans and Africans. It's a very complex issue, which has to do with that. Where you got educated, who educated you, what were you being taught, etc.
Our congregation was addressing this issue, and so we invited one of our congregation that was Nigerian, I think I told you about her, to share with us what we could do in our congregation that would be more like your culture, and if we could maybe adapt something. And she said, well, there is something different. She said, when we take up the offering, we don't pass a basket. We all dance it forward. And I could just see all of us dancing up there. And, you know, it sounded like it'd be kind of fun. And we did have her dance for us before they moved away, but we still aren't dancing our.
and the man you were with said, and don't put it all in the first time.
Yeah, that's right, because they go up
separately,
you know, the first time they
yes.
go up separately.
Yes, of course, those are some of the problems that we are having, in the sense that, you see, some of them are really very sad jokes, but they are real jokes, and the consciousness of time, for example, is one of the really sad jokes. You really don't know when you'll come back from church, and you don't even have to ask when you'll come, because you don't know. Mm-hmm. It can go on and on and on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And if they really get into the mood, that is, the congregation get into the mood, it will be hard to say, okay, final hymn, let's close. I mean, it's not a very, very time conscious. In as much as that in itself, it's another way of letting the spirit to be, you enjoy it, but sometimes it really becomes an inconvenience when you try to budget your time, and you're like a very careful German or European, you say, you know, after church I want to go ABC and so on, it becomes very difficult. You shall sometimes need to say, you know, I may be in church the whole day and accept that. So some of these, like singing when you take offerings, it's one of the high points of a service, but it can also be very long, because a person would have a dollar and change it into 10 dimes and then go there 10 times. I mean, the point is, I'm going to contribute this dollar, full stop, but then it goes there so many times, and it's part of the fun. So when you work in the congregations, you need to be careful to nest some of these things and see how you do it, because it's there, you find it, it's how they do it.
But the congregations are, in a sense, freer to do that. a little bit more encouraged at their own self. To the minister, whatever the bishop wants to do might be one thing, but what they do is what they're going to do.
Yes.
Make those decisions. And that is a difference to say even 30 years ago. It's not.
Is there a Lutheran church in Africa?
Oh, yeah. Let's start now from the remarks that I made. Africa is very big. Two, there are a number of Lutheran churches which did mission work in Africa. In East Africa, for example, mainly I think to the American Lutheran Church, I'm not sure which one of the American Lutheran Churches did a lot of mission in Tanzania area, for example. In South Africa, we had the fortune of having the Norwegian Mission Society, the Benin Mission Society, and to a very, very large, minor extent, the Swedish Mission Society did mission work there. In other words, they established and sent bishops. And so we by the time we got together as Lutheran churches in South Africa, we had all these traditions represented from the debate as to whether do you wear a black tala or do you wear a white alb and then so on and so on. In other Africans, you have the Missouri Synod doing mission work there. So you have Lutherans of the Missouri, especially East Africa, Ghana, Nigeria, and so on and so on. So you have there is a very large Lutheran family or community in Africa as a whole, from Sudan, Ethiopia, to Southern Africa, East, West, and so on. It's well represented in Zimbabwe, or the largest Lutheran community is in Namibia, and then it was due to the Finnish mission and Lutherans and the German Lutherans.
Is it still true? I mean, one of the things which is very impressive to me was a visit of a number of Ugandan priests and seminary, I think, at a time when the church was persecuted. And in an interesting way, it seemed to me it was almost like a gift to the American church, because a lot of what's in the scriptural history makes a lot more sense viewed in the setting of persecution than it does in our society, the way we experience it here today. And you know, that was very Ugandan and things like that. That's still a strain. I know the church grew enormously during that time in Uganda, but it was the Anglican church.
Yes. Yes, I think that one of the ironies of history is precisely that a certain spirituality, certain spiritual virtues can get sent back from people who lost them. I mean, if you want to see where the church started, say for example in areas of Athens and so on, Turkey for an example, which really was the center of Christianity, people would say, man, we should maybe begin to take back certain things which are no longer there. And the same is happening with the relationship between the mission churches and their mission partners in Africa, that there is a time where by divine order, the mission churches were much spiritually, one can say, poorer than the people they did mission with. So much that they needed those people to enrich them now, to talk back to them and say, listen, you taught us about love, but we don't see it, you know, amongst you. Why don't you begin to do this? And this is exactly what happened with that phase. Mm-hmm. And that is not only in Uganda. Maybe for the Anglican Church, I know it's Uganda, there was Bishop Fisto Kunambiri, if I get his name. He played a great role. But for example, you look at the Catholic Church in the history, in the struggle, in the liberation struggle in Zimbabwe, Rhodesia. Many nuns were killed many, the Catholic Church stood firm. It operated what they call peace and justice, or justice and reconciliation division. And it recorded a lot of things. And in the end, there was a really lively spirituality there in the Catholic Church. Now, if you go to South Africa, it's more broader, because South Africa has got all these denominations, from the Presbyterian, Episcopalian. You've got Bishop Tutu on the one hand, Alan Busack in the Reformed, and in the Lutheran Church, you have people like Farisani, who really suffered unbelievably. And now such people are able to come out and speak to the world and say, because of being a Christian, I was able to stand APC. And that it speaks a lot to people. And so, yes, there is that mutual enriching that happens. And it doesn't necessarily happen all the time. Like, I wouldn't say that's still the case in Uganda. Because sometimes you get relaxed when the political fortunes gets into your favor, and then you forget about certain things that meant a lot at that time.
While you were in prison, were you treated any differently because you were a Christian?
Yeah, that is that phase. I would say that there was an unbelievable hostility, because the ideology of the state was that you are a communist, that's why you're in prison. And if you say to them, no, I believe in God, possibly the same God that you believe in, and they really did not want to buy that, and they would be very, very hostile to you. I know for my personal experience that I had great difficulties with them. The head of the prison, a colonel of the prison, who basically targeted me because he heard that I'm a pastor. I've said that quite often. It, of course, once you see, there is one thing to be ill-treated generally like everybody else, maybe because you are a man or so on. It's a different thing to be singled out because of the choices you made in life, being a pastor, being a Christian. It kind of gives you more reason for being that. And so it of course increased my resolve to say that I'm not going to back down from who I am. It happens with me. I would say that the number of things came into my favor. The publicity of the torture of certain prisoners before me, it made them to be a little bit careful, to be afraid to do that, and they would do it if they know they could get away with it. The nuisancical letters they got from people like here in Holland and the Amnesty International, the ELCA churches, it kind of made them feel just annoyed. Why is this? Do we have to be reminded that there is a prisoner here? And as a result, they began to be hostile in a way that simply removed certain privileges that I would naturally have access to, like other prisoners. But then they did not physically touch me, because they just didn't know where they will end up. And it helped me, because other people suffered more worse than that. Yeah, now maybe unless somebody has a question, I can just briefly give you a short outline of some of the things that we may be discussing, even though you may not have an opportunity because you have to try and get. One of the things that I will try to look at is the issue of looking at the forms of a formation, what you call education, that our traditional societies had, in particular initiation, and compare it with the confirmation when it came, when they began to be Christians and they were asked to use confirmation as a substitute for initiation. to look at the problems that came and then the advantages and the pluses and the minuses of that whole program. The interest here is to look at how our systems of preparing the youth for life outside are better off than the previous ones. And my thesis here is that the African math means was doing much better than what the Christian substitute did. And of course, with quotation that one needs to be very careful today because the needs are completely different. Somebody has to learn typing and computer. Whereas in the past, the greatest skills a young man could have would be to know when to make a girl pregnant and when not to make him. That was the most important skill. And also to know how to make a living. And the greatest skills a woman could know would be how to identify illnesses in a child and how to heal those illnesses. And then also how to make a home. Now all those things in this whole change is the youth formation. It's an interesting phase that we pass through, and I'm trying to revisit it. The other element is to look at the whole history again of missions and missionaries. And my interest here is to look at how the whole problem of human beings used in the mission of God and the compromises and difficulties and all the things that are related to that, because I think that's one of the most interesting things about the reality that this was the mission of God. When these missionaries went to Africa to plant churches, it was the mission of God. And when you look at the personalities of some of these missionaries, it just boggles your mind that God can choose such people. And I think it's very interesting because it makes you begin to understand how God works. Even today, you look at your pastors and many people who are doing God's work, it becomes interesting. Because we would wish that angels would have come there, but that was not God's way of choosing. And yet, in the middle of that, we will begin to see that there were certain real angelic figures who did mission, who were missionaries. When we begin to look at the whole problem of missions and missionaries, and I'm posing a question: was it a blessing or a curse for Africa? And later on, I will look at the spirituality of Africans, looking at how the ancestral veneration, ancestorship, was easily accepted could be a service substitute. No. How the veneration of saints in Africa easily became popular because it was very much in line with ancestorship. So you cannot understand why saintology or what is called hagiology is a very growing popular ritual in Africa, unless you begin to see it within the ritual of or the spirituality of ancestors. But then the spirituality of ancestors is a very complex thing on its own. It's very complex. It's a science on its own. And I don't want to bore you with those things. I will conclude sometime by looking at the clash of cultures, which I call the battle of gods, because in some respect, when Christianity came to Africa, African life was seen as it had certain divines. And so the only way in which the Christian divines could make a presence, they had to fight with the local divines in terms of who controls illness, who controls death, who controls fortune, who controls what, rain, etc. You had to prove them that your God of rain or your God of harvest is not stronger than this other God. And so this was a very, very serious, you know, the whole Christianization was, it's an interesting, very sometimes a very painful episode. But within the struggle of the gods, it was also a struggle of systems. If you take even an example, if you take Britain, you've got the royalty or monarchy. Now you can imagine if you bring a new system which basically does not even recognize that system. And it becomes certain families who were making fortune out of these divines which were there becomes reduced to nothing. And then there was a battle. There was the economy and so on and so on. So that will be my final lecture. And part of my wish is that people could engage me. People could make it challenging by asking questions. You all know, you all come from rich cultures. You have Viking gods and so on. We just reflect as what some of those things meant, you know, how it meant for people to carve a sheep in such a way that it had a particular image in front, so that all the evil spirits of the ocean, which are unknown, the hurricanes, when they see this sheep emerging in the darkness, can give way. I mean, this is a big spirituality that people choose to think, well, doesn't mean anything. Well, thank you for today.